Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show where we tell the story behind your favorite Asian dishes. I'm Linda Liu, and on the line is my co-host in Hong Kong, Iris Van Kerkhove.
Good morning from Hong Kong.
We are broadcasting from Heritage Radio Network, our British Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, Iris and I dig deep on a dish or an aspect of Asian cuisine, and we interview experts on the topic.
Before we get into today's show, Linda and I like to kick off the episode with a question for each other. What's the best thing you ate in the past week?
Okay, so hands down, it has got to be the sushi omakase at Shuko. And I know we usually don't call out the specific topic we're discussing here, but I'd be lying if I didn't answer with this. So I went by the restaurant last Friday, and there were so many pieces of fresh and delicious fish that I really lost count. But chefs, Jimmy and Nick, really laid it out on one piece that you cannot forget. It was a beautiful and, dare I say, life-changing concoction. It had a trifecta of toro, uni, caviar on top, and they put a flake of 24K gold leaf. They dubbed this the mic drop, and it really was. It was as delicious as it was beautiful. Oh, yeah. How about you, Iris?
Jealous. So, what did I have? I was going to talk about another banh mi, which I had, which was pretty good, but change of plans, because last night I went to a place called Maison Libanaise, Lebanese restaurant in Hong Kong that I had never tried before. And one dish in particular, the pan-fried halloumi, it was like glazed with honey and had dates and some sort of dressing that I actually didn't have time to analyze because I just destroyed that halloumi. It was so good.
Halloumi, it's amazing, and it's great for the summer too.
Yeah, exactly. But so back to today's show. Like Linda mentioned, we're going to talk about a food that I can't believe we haven't talked about yet, considering we're a radio show about Asian food, but I think it's because we were waiting for the right guest. That food is sushi, and we'll be focusing on the concept of omakase. For those who aren't familiar with the term, omakase is a Japanese phrase that means, I'll leave it up to you. So what that means is, rather than ordering a la carte, you leave it up to the chef and select dishes for you. It's an opportunity for chefs to showcase the best ingredients as well as their skills and allows for creative freedom. The chefs are usually in front of you so you can watch them work and interact with them. Omakase is most commonly associated with sushi, but not limited to it.
Yeah, and to talk about sushi and omakase is Nick Kim and Jimmy Lau. They are co-chefs and co-owners of Shuko. They met in 2005 when they were both working at Masa in Columbus Circle. In 2012, they partnered on their first solo project, Netta, to explore their modern interpretation of a traditional sushi counter, which received rave reviews, including 2 stars from the New York Times. The following year, they left Netta to focus on their own restaurant, Shuko, which is a restaurant off Union Square that offers daily sushi, omakase, and kaiseki tasting menus. Their menu reflects the best fish selections and seasonal ingredients sourced locally and internationally. It was easily the most fun I've had eating sushi, and quite possibly the best sushi I've ever had, too. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, welcome to the show. And fun fact, my boss, Matt Abergel, also worked at Masa and knows Nick and Jimmy. And they even did pop-ups at each other's restaurants this year. So, small world.
Right.
Yeah, very timely. Okay, so we just kind of want to start out with asking both of you, where are you from originally, and how did you get into the culinary world?
Oh, I'm Jimmy Lau. I'm from the South China. It's actually I born from Fujian, the Fujian, and I came to like early 90s. I came to the New York with the family, and when I interested to the to the cook was back to my
like about, while you were still in China.
Yes. Yes, it was because I was the first cook, and then I failed to make the noodle for my dad, and then totally failed, and then that make me want to cook to good food.
Do it even harder.
Yes, I was so embarrassed.
Wow, for family honor. Okay. What about you, Nick?
Parents Korean, raised in Los Angeles. Got into cooking over a girl. Fast forward, here I am.
Okay, very personal stories here. Okay, so how did the bromance start at Masa? Like, what did you see in each other that allowed this, like, continued partnership to flourish?
I think it's over food, over the A to Z, how to prepare it, how to handle it, how to eat it and enjoy it. I think that we had that in common, and so it was really easy to build a relationship from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that time, you know, Nick and I, so when we work at Masa there, so when 3 o'clock, that means lunch break time. Mm-hmm. And then Nick and I was there, everyone was outside to smoke or something, take a break. So Nick and I was always Nico was keep it prepping, doing the fish or something. Mm-hmm. And we next to each other, always talking about it.
Yeah, food, the proximity of it.
Yeah, it's a lot of talking about, and there was all kind of things more about
like
the
dreams.
Food. Yeah, and what's the future, what we gonna do, and the things, and then we kind of think the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we say, one day maybe we should do something.
Wow, the most productive lunchtime conversation ever. Okay, so you guys went off and, worked at Netta. What actually drove you to open Shuko together?
I think the space that we found, Shuko space, it was sort of saying, in a weird way, what did it want it to be, how did it want it to be designed, and from that we were sort of driven to make all that fit with the mm-hmm. menu and the way the restaurant was laid out.
Very cool. So did you kind of actively look for a space for another project, something that was different from what you guys were doing at Netta?
The concept was really the driving force of mm-hmm. Building Shuko, the concept.
How would you describe that?
The restaurant itself, the outside, we don't have a sign, we don't have a window.
It's very speakeasy.
It's very hidden, yes. And not on, it's sort of on purpose, but once again, the design of the space sort of was, what we heard was block everybody in, make it dark and make it intimate. Mm-hmm. And the space is sort of kooky because it has downstairs, upstairs, and little rooms tucked in alcoves, and it had a lot of little characters.
Mm-hmm. And what does the name mean?
Shuko means, it's actually an old Japanese word where fishermen used to go out, and then when they used to come back, would go to a shuko, which was sort of a bar for fishermen where they would eat and drink sake. And so shukos are sort of interpretation of that.
Very cool. And so does that mean it has like a more lively atmosphere? You're like driving to something where like originally like the fishermen would be comfortable like chatting with each other?
Well, just doing the research on the word shuko, it seemed like a little rough, you know, because fishermen are, I don't think they're the most graceful type. And eating things that like dried sardines and dried innards and drinking sake and eating these things, you know, after a work day. So I think we like the concept of eating and drinking and that. So we sort of took that idea and just kind of spun it our way.
Mm-hmm. And did you guys set out to open a omakase and kaiseki restaurant? Was that like a intention?
I think for the most part, yes. I think at that time it was a little less omakase restaurants, so it was a little bit more. There had to been, you know, we had to think more about it than I think you do now. And so, yeah, definitely. Once all the pieces were coming together, that seemed like it made the most sense.
Mm-hmm. So since there's two of you, how do you guys split up your roles at the restaurant? And how do you guys, like, complement each other in terms of your personalities?
Well, everybody loves Jimmy. It's hard not to love.
He has the best one-liners.
Right. Gives good hugs and, you know, very, very hard to be mad at him. You know,
I think every work, so like even in a family, you have to like a dad, mom, you have to separate things, so mm-hmm. you one have to, you know, catch things and to say something, and the one you other hand, so you have to make the people calm down, so mm-hmm. make a child is not, you know,
right? Are you the calming like one then?
Yeah, we can say like mom and dad like that.
Got it. Does that like ever switch, or you're like pretty consistent?
Yeah, we do some switch. Sometimes we switch.
And so how do you guys, like, especially with the nature of omakase in the city now, there's definitely more and more. How do you stay differentiated, or what do you feel like are some different points that you guys offer at Shuko compared to other restaurants?
I think we haven't really changed anything. I think we're just forever just fine-tuning what we started off with. And, you know, every day, every service is a brand new sort of day. So we're still forever trying to make that perfect service day. And within ourselves is sort of the challenge.
Yeah. And do you feel like because you guys come from some, like, European training, does that have an impact on the food and the service?
For sure. I think even our chef de cuisine, Brian, he comes from a European background. So definitely there's some influences throughout the menu.
Yeah. Let's talk about, like, yeah, the vibe, too. So while I was there, I was kind of singing along to some Rihanna, Beyonce. So that's not really typical to, like, the omakase experience. I feel like that could potentially be, like, a bit more sterile. So, like, how do omakase traditionalists feel when they come to the restaurant?
We hope they're comfortable and just sort of, you know, go for the ride. But I think there's sometimes
are they surprised, do you think?
Yes, I think so. You know, sometimes, but in a positive way.
Yeah, I think the reputation in the food industry is that you guys are trying to make omakase fun again. Do you agree with that, like, assessment, or...
I don't think that was our intent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, you know, the music really was just, you know, it's really like, you know, growing up in Los Angeles, music is really a big part of growing up and having older brothers and sisters. And once again, I come from like a CD record era, so music is a big part of waking up to, going to sleep to, and so naturally when opening a restaurant, I sort of made that a priority.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's sort of a blurry line to do that type of music and try to still maintain a proper service.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our team does a really good job of doing that.
Yeah, I definitely thought so too. And talking about the food too, there were points where you know, Jimmy was introducing us to like a lot of spice on the sushi, and I feel like that's not typical. Yeah, there's like more bold flavors there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's a bit like something that you're bringing from your background?
Actually, I like a Sichuan food, so mm-hmm. and the Sichuan food kind of like a pretty spicy, and then the other things is so when you like you feel like our sushi kind of like we try to put like all different like flavors, mm-hmm. like we put that kombu sauce, like umami things and the sea chili and spices, kind of like you know, one
yeah,
the other. So
I do that, feel like you're layering it and yeah. like telling a story.
Yeah, and of course actually that's on the customer side, like because we prefer the we do the omakase, so actually like everyone eat kind of over 10-20 pieces about that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of piece, and then when in the fish actually they have their own taste, but once you eat a lot of pieces over like 5-6 pieces, and then become very similar.
Yeah.
And then because you kind of eat it, and then if every piece like just wasabi, soy sauce, and the rice, and the fish, and then we kind of like it's good, but the more like you don't feel like a pop
yeah.
or something that you kind of like after that kind of
such a good point.
Yeah. And that's why we and Nick and I we kind of starting to
you make play with the yeah. palate and the different like
yeah.
profiles of taste. It's almost like when you're starting out, like, drinking some good wine, and after a couple bottles, you're like, whatever you're drinking kind of tastes the same.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
How do you, after, like, the 10th glass, how do you even know after 4 hours of eating? And
yeah,
know?
And that's when you put a gold leaf on it.
Yeah, also, like, you know, in Chinese, right, we, I think, not only Chinese, I think anywhere like Asian or Eastern so Western that they call like a color first, right? Color and then mm-hmm. smells
yeah.
and then taste is the last one, so sometimes like gold that things that catch your eyeball.
Oh,
so
yeah.
sometimes you know color that will make you already think, oh, this gold, and that
it's already setting the precedence.
Yeah,
for,
you
like,
already, because
yeah.
I saw you, like, you already got it. Oh, 24K gold, like, getting exciting.
I know, this must taste like gold, and it did.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, more like that, yes.
Oh, that's a really good way to put uh-huh. it. And so, what do you guys think, what does it take to make a good omakase? So, we talked about, you know, having exciting kind of storytelling with the flavors and not like boring the customer.
I think if I had to choose a word, it has to be cohesive.
Mm.
It just has to make sense, because you could put anything out there and say that's omakase, but I think it should first and foremost be at the moment, the season, and from the season, it needs to be sort of for us, we like temperature, and once again different effects of sound, or when you hear something searing, you know, mm-hmm. it kind of wakes you up a little bit too as a customer if you're sitting there for like an hour plus. So I think cohesive if I had to choose.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you were saying something about like, yeah, like anyone could call it omakase, but so I was wondering, is there like a rule book to when you can become a sushi chef and serve omakase, or like a church of sushi that you have to like register and put your name down? Does such a thing
there
exist?
There is.
There is?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't. I mean, I think it's just sort of a era thing. I think just coming up in my era, I think cooks were a little bit more hesitant to come out of wherever they were working at or training at, because feeling like it's, you need one more year or one more of this to actually leave to open something. It was just a little bit more, I guess, people wanted more research, more information, more experience. Mm-hmm. I think nowadays with everything, you don't need all that many years and travel around the world to open something. You could just go on a vacation now and open a restaurant, come back and open a restaurant. So I think it's just sort of a different playing field now.
Yeah.
In a good way too.
Mm-hmm.
It helps the matter, I think. It helps. Yeah. It helps the industry.
The like creativity and right. the options out right. there. And I was wondering if there are some like etiquette that we should, you know, tell the listeners about eating omakase, or even like how to optimize your experience as a customer, because you are like giving up control to the chef here. What are some tips?
I guess for me it would be probably to try to eat the pieces in a certain amount of time. Because it starts to sort of go somewhere else. It starts to change. And we serve our rice warm as well. Our rice, we just sort of resourced a rice from Japan, Yamagata, where there's a sprout still attached to it. So it's very rare type of rice. And so we're very excited about
very
using
cool.
that. And that, you know, once again, if the rice... you know, is made and it's not eaten at a certain time, it starts to, I think, start
change
to miss
in, like flavor.
It just misses the peak.
Yeah.
Sort of going back from the peak.
Got it. And then I know while Jimmy was giving us each piece of sushi, he was like, you know, putting it on the same plate in the same place, and you know, we're expected to like eat that with our hands, and that's pretty typical, right? That's like a traditional way to go about it.
Yeah, actually, the sushi in Japan, the original was the, like a street food things, and then we just like I think in the late 90s, and they're getting like a refined, and now getting like a fine dining things, and then we just like a kind of little back to before the original feel, like hand finger.
Like yeah. simple and faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was really fun, actually. Have you ever had customers who were, like, uncomfortable with that process, who, like, didn't want to leave all the decisions to you guys? I mean, a lot of Americans do order sushi a la carte. So, like, were there any experiences you had where people were surprised by the omakase?
Some. I think we've been fortunate to avoid a lot of that, but definitely some, definitely, in the beginning at least.
Yeah.
But after the first year, I think more omakase restaurants started to open up, so I think it became a little bit more normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And then I mentioned one memorable piece earlier, but what are some of your favorite and most like special pieces of fish you've served?
I like the scallop a lot. Yeah.
Because it's like fresh and sweet and the...
Yeah, it's kind of like a natural sweet, and I like it just a little bit salt on there, and they can pick up the ocean flavor. Yeah, you taste that, but
I did. Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, like
I was like, if
candy.
I could order something again, that was like definitely on the reorder list. What about you, Nick?
I tend to like more mackerel fishy fish. The more fishier it is, the more enjoyment I get. Sort of opposite of like fresh in a mackerel way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And it has to be fresh for that to be done well.
Well, there's the other opposite where you age it and you could salt
Yes, it goes, that's true.
And I love Eeyore.
Mm-hmm. All the fish.
Yes.
So I saw the Vice Munchies video. That was really fun. We'll post it on our blog in our show notes. Was there anything foraged in the menu on Friday?
This Friday, I don't think so.
What are some of the things that you might like forage and bring to the menu?
And where do you forage in New York City?
Central Park.
Secrets out.
Well, Jimmy, I think the last thing we were bringing in was the Miyoga from Jimmy's garden. He has a house in Connecticut, so he could, you know, he could bring some for, but not for like mass production, but a good enough, good amount.
That's really fun. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West, and we're here with Nick and Jimmy, the chefs from Shuko. So we were wondering how you guys stay inspired. Do you try omakases like everywhere you go?
No, I think just being interested in food, and we're cooks at the end of the day, so our language is, our conversation is a lot. It's actually a little sad because it's about food a lot. And sometimes it goes into like how it feels, how one makes you feel.
Mm-hmm. I think you're talking to the right listeners here. This is your audience.
No, actually, Nick and I was the like we not that much, but we did like we went to the Japan before open the Shuko, so we kind of it's very little trip, but. That's a 5 days trip, and we kind of every day just try different food, and then to like a kind of research, or, but
yeah,
so yeah, but yeah, kind of like that.
And I guess are there like seasonal aspects that you incorporate too? Local, seasonal, I don't know, international as well.
I think we're definitely New York, sort of follow the New York season. Proudly, and as everybody knows, New York could sort of be a little bit difficult in the winter.
Yeah,
and
it's like root vegetables, everything.
Right, you know, I think here in New York, I think all the restaurants do a really great job on techniques and how to sort of showcase some of the dark age root vegetables that occur in the winter. It almost goes unnoticed because I think here in New York, everyone does a really good job on that.
Yeah. So what are some of the best omakase experiences you've had in the past? Other than your own, of course.
Yes, Nick and I went to the Tokyo there, and I tried sushi soya. So masa,
that one was really good.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Very special.
What do you think like made that one special?
we're both into clams, and and he did like 100 different ways of clams, so it like spoke right to us.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's like our third brother.
Yeah. And do you feel like there are trends in omakase?
Definitely. I think just like with anything else, when it's like at the moment, mm-hmm. it sort of...
Have you noticed anything recently that like folks are doing, or even that you guys like to capture in your menus?
Seems, you know, obviously the uni, sea urchin, is sort of all over the place, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
The torching seems to be all over the place as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if those are considered so much a fad.
Right.
I think people have been torching for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
But the ingredient probably be uni.
Yeah. I really liked how you highlighted uni from two different places. So while I was there, I had the Santa Barbara uni compared with the Hokkaido uni, right?
Yes.
yeah. And that was really fun because I think side by side, you really taste the differences and it's like a taste test and it's like very engaging and interactive. And I don't think you regularly get that kind of experience.
Glad to hear.
Do you feel like the omakase landscape is like changing over time, especially like regarding the sourcing and availability of fish? What's going to happen here?
What's going to happen? Well, we use a lot of farm raised. Mm-hmm. Where it's sort of in a control sort of environment. Even the tuna is farm raised from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that movement helps the matter. Sort of stop the wild fishing where it sort of like the tuna.
Yeah.
So farm raised for us, it works.
Very cool. And do you think, you know, that's going to change, like, the future of omakase? Like, what will that look like? Will there be as many, like, varieties? Or do you think, like, chefs will be driven to be more creative or incorporate, like, ingredients outside of the typical seafood spectrum?
I think all of the above.
Yeah.
Like even us, we're finding new local fish that we haven't used before. And it might have been a Japanese cousin version of it, but grown locally and equally as good.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the season's a little off than in Japan, but I think we're still discovering certain species that we're happy to use.
That's cool. What are you guys excited about? What gets you excited about the omakase menus that you craft these days?
It's always usually about the guest for us, I think. I mean, that's really the driving point every day, it feels like. Our meetings, our point of views are always on ensuring that the guest is happy and enjoying themselves.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
Yes, I agree.
And so how long do you think you'll be doing this for?
Well, hopefully for a while.
Very cool.
Right.
And what is next for you guys? Do you have other projects lined up, or is your focus, you know, solely on Shuko right now?
Yeah, we're... spend a lot of time on our current restaurant, but we're always open to other projects and because we also want the team to grow as
mm-hmm.
well. We have such a good team that I think you know, they all sort of deserve to grow with us. So very excited about that as well.
Yeah. And it's cool. It sounds like, you know, there's gardening and foraging projects still. There's like renovation that's happening
yes.
to the alcove area
yes.
at the
yep.
restaurant.
Very excited about that.
Cool. So lots of developments.
Yes.
And so that just wraps up our show for tonight. So for listeners who want to learn more about Shuko, how should they stay connected with you guys?
Website. I think that's probably the best way.
You guys active on Instagram, all
Definitely,
the social medias?
All of that.
Do you have personal handles too, or just like the main restaurant one?
Jimmy does. I really don't.
No, actually, like a short contact to the main restaurant one. So I'm very bad with that. I have my Facebook or Instagram, but I don't spend the time on that.
It's okay. The focus goes to the fish and the customer.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks,
I can't
guys.
Wait to visit Shugo next time I'm in town.
Please.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in, everyone. We are approaching the end of our summer season here at Feast Meets West. So we do want to remind listeners a great way to stay updated is to join our mailing list. You can sign up at feastmeetswest.com/newsletter or click the sign up button on our Facebook page. We'll be back next week with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.